Welcome to the Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar.com. This podcast is brought to you by MFS Investment Management, backed by 40 years of essential fixed income. Markets change, but the role fixed income plays shouldn't. That's why we stay true to our traditional approach, essential fixed income. Find out more at mfs.com/fixed income. This week on the podcast, three new Morningstar medalists, Christine Benz with four hidden benefits of Roth IRAs, a pending manager departure for T. Rowe Price High Yield, Allergan's future looks promising, and Ben Johnson says index funds aren't all passive. Let's get started. First, three new Morningstar medalists.
Hi, I'm Susie Jabinski from Morningstar.com. Morningstar regularly reevaluates the fund analyst ratings on the funds under analyst coverage. Here are three funds whose analyst ratings have been upgraded during the past few months. These funds are now among our Morningstar medalists.
We recently upgraded PIMCO Dynamic Bond's Morningstar analyst rating to bronze from neutral. This fund used to be called PIMCO Unconstrained Bond, and it had a rough period from 2013 through 2015. It went through, it had four different lead managers during that period in quick succession. And when the current lead manager, Mark Seidner, came aboard, He had a pretty rough stretch in 2015, just right out of the gate. So, there are a few reasons driving the upgrade for the fund at this time. The first is that PIMCO, a little more than a year ago, cut fees on the fund. The fund's not exactly cheap, but it's no longer prohibitively expensive, so that should help its chances going forward. Also, the team has stabilized quite a bit. Mark Seidner's now been the lead manager here for 4 years. And more importantly, Seidner has also made some key improvements to the process. This strategy has a wide latitude to invest in a lot of the bond market's riskier sectors, which means mistakes can be costly. So Seidner has been focused more on risk management and making sure that any individual bets or risk factors aren't driving the fund's returns. So the fund has done pretty well with this more circumspect approach through a variety of markets in the last couple of years. And that gives us confidence that what we saw from the fund in 2015 is going to be more the exception than the rule. That, plus the wealth of resources at PIMCO, should help this fund be one of the better performers in the non-traditional bond category from here.
To kick off the new year, AQR put a new spin on its risk parity fund. The fund is now called AQR Multi-Asset, and we recently upgraded its Morningstar analyst rating to bronze. The fund is still pretty balanced across risks, kind of like risk parity. It has a lot of exposure to equities, interest rates, and commodities. And unlike 60-40 funds that are predominantly driven by the equity exposure, this fund should be driven equally by risks to equities, interest rates, and commodities. As part of the makeover, AQR switched out its equity exposure from market cap weighted indices to its stock selection model. And the stock selection model is one we have high confidence in. It picks stocks based on tried and true factors like value and momentum. True, in 2018, the model did struggle when value had a really poor year, and it should struggle when factors aren't doing that well. But overall, we think it's a good long-term strategy. The fund also has, its large exposures to commodities interest rates, which make it look really different than peers, and it should perform really differently. So it could be hard to hold on to this fund if you don't know what to expect. We think over the long term, it has all the components to be a strong, diversifying fund for most portfolios.
Improved resources across the Capital Group American Fund's fixed income efforts, including improved analytical tools, sharpened quantitative risk models, as well as more coordinated macroeconomic guidance across the fixed income suite, have all strengthened the process at American Fund's Short-Term Bond Fund of America. The addition of a third portfolio manager with a focus on securitized FAIR, as well as the existing principal investment officer and a rates-focused co-manager, all provide extra oomph to this process. These process enhancements should assist this fund with its goal of providing ballast when markets turn volatile, and for this reason, it receives a Morningstar analyst rating upgrade to bronze from neutral.
Overwhelmed by the market? Morningstar Premium will help you cut through the noise and find the most promising investments. Get started today with Morningstar Premium.
Next, four hidden benefits of Roth IRAs.
For Morningstar, I'm Jeremy Glazer, joined today by Christine Benz. She's our Director of Personal Finance. We're going to look at four lesser-known reasons that investors may want to prefer Roth IRAs. Christine, thanks for joining me.
Jeremy, it's great to be here.
The benefits of Roth IRAs are pretty well known. You put in after-tax dollars, and those grow tax-free for your lifetime. But beyond that, there's some other attributes of the account that could be pretty attractive. What's one of the kind of lesser known features of these accounts?
Well, it's well known among people who are getting close to retirement, but one perhaps less well known feature to people who are young accumulators is this idea of not having to take required distributions later in life. And I hear so much from retirees where they are withdrawing most of their living expenses from traditional IRAs, which are subject to ordinary income tax. And they also represent the RMDs, the required minimum distributions, represent a little bit of a loss of control over your tax picture that you had earlier on in retirement. So being able to avoid required minimum distributions, which you're able to do with Roth IRAs, is a huge selling point, in my opinion.
The second is that there's a lot of flexibility here.
There is. And this is one of the main reasons why, when I talk to young savers who aren't sure where to start saving, I often recommend a Roth IRA because you have so much flexibility in terms of those withdrawals. So you can withdraw your contributions at any time and for any reason without any taxes or penalties. And that's one reason why I recommend a Roth IRA as a good emergency fund vehicle. So even if you have the best of intentions and you plan to leave the money in there until your retirement, you can save within the confines of a Roth IRA, presumably in something a little bit safer, and build up critical mass in safe assets before you start saving in long-term assets.
If I go onto the IRS website, it's going to say that I have an income limit about who can contribute to a Roth IRA, but it might be a little bit less well-known that there's a way around that.
That's right. So there are income limits on contributions to Roth IRAs. What there aren't income limits on are conversions from traditional IRA assets to Roth. And so back in 2010, I believe, this idea of a backdoor Roth IRA contribution was born. And the basic idea is that you fund a traditional IRA, it's a non-deductible contribution because if you earn too much to make a Roth IRA contribution, you automatically earn too much to deduct your contribution. But you make that non-deductible traditional IRA contribution, and then you convert those assets to Roth assets. So this strategy won't make sense in every situation. One profile who needs to be especially careful would be the person who has significant traditional IRA assets elsewhere, apart from this little starter IRA that they're doing. So get some tax help before embarking on a backdoor Roth IRA maneuver. But it is a way for high-income folks to get some money into an IRA, and in particular into a Roth IRA.
And Roths can be a good way to get more money into a tax-advantaged account as well.
Yeah, I think this is something that's not discussed so much. But as you said, Jeremy, at the top, you're making contributions of money that has already been taxed. And yet these contribution limits are identical, whether you're doing a traditional or a Roth contribution. And so in my mind, one of the virtues of the Roth is that if you are, say, a higher income person and you're in a position to make the full IRA contribution of $6,000 if you're under 50 or $7,000 if you're over 50, well, effectively, you're putting that much more in from the get-go because you're putting in after-tax dollars.
But the Roth isn't right for everybody.
It's not. So that's a great point, Jeremy. There are profiles for whom a traditional IRA is going to be preferable. One of the key categories that I would point to would be the person who's a later career saver who thinks, well, I haven't really saved that much for retirement. It may be that my income tax bracket is higher than it will be when I'm pulling the money out in retirement. For people like that who can get a deduction on their IRA contribution, they may well be better doing the traditional deductible IRA contribution and skipping the Roth.
Christine, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
For Morningstar, I'm Jeremy Glazer. Thanks for watching.
Watch all the Morningstar content you love from your living room. Download the Morningstar Roku channel and get up-to-date independent insights on today's markets. Be comfortable. Be informed.
Now, Kenneth Ashadi on T. Rowe Price High Yield.
Despite a pending manager departure, we believe that its strong team, steady process, and relatively cheap fees make T. Rowe Price High Yield a solid choice. Following more than two decades as lead manager, Mark Veselkov plans to step away from day-to-day portfolio management responsibilities effective January 1st, 2020. With plans to take the helm following Veselkov's departure, Rodney Rayburn was appointed to the fund as a co-manager on January 14, 2019. He joined T. Rowe in 2014 and has served as portfolio manager of T. Rowe Price Credit Opportunities since July 2015. The team also includes 14 credit analysts and 2 associate analysts. After Vasilkev's departure, the group plans to continue to implement the same value-driven process. It seeks bonds with compelling valuations that are issued by firms primed for a turnaround. Accordingly, many of the fund's holdings have split ratings. Non-U.S. high-yield bonds and out-of-benchmark holdings, including equities and bank loans, also figure prominently here. The fund's long-term record is strong versus peers and owes much to deft moves by Vasilkev. Most recently, his decision to avoid the high-yield market's most distressed names helped the fund to hold up better than 60% of distinct peers when high-yield fares struggled during 2018's fourth quarter. And overall, the fund's 6.6% annualized return landed among the best-performing quartile of its Morningstar cohort over the 15-year stretch in January 2019. The fund's overall experienced and robust team, consistent process, and affordable expenses support its Morningstar analyst rating of bronze.
This podcast is brought to you by MFS Investment Management, backed by 40 years of essential fixed income. Your fixed income strategies should aim to deliver the essentials for your clients: income, diversification, and risk management. Find out more at mfs.com/fixed income. Next, Michael Waterhouse on Allergan's future.
Despite looming generic competition on a few key products like Restasis, we still believe Widemo Allergan's current stock price still reflects too much pessimism for the company's outlook. While the market is preoccupied with the upcoming launches of new aesthetic neurotoxins in the U.S. market and the effect of the new class of CGRP monoclonal antibodies in chronic migraine for Botox's therapeutic sales, we still expect limited market share losses and pricing pressure for Botox in this high barrier to entry and limited competition market. Besides injection differences among products, Botox retains the most diverse set of approved indications that should help preserve high market share. These competitive issues make 2019 a transition year for Allergan, but we think the optics on the horizon are improving as Allergan advances a number of key pipeline products through late-stage clinical trials, including Ubrogepant and Atogepant for migraine, Abicipar for macular degeneration, Rapastinel for major depressive disorder, CBC for NASH, and Relimorelin for gastroparesis. For patient long-term investors, we think Allergan's future looks more promising than the current stock price at 8x adjusted 2019 earnings would suggest.
Go from one investment analyst to 150. Sign up today for Morningstar Premium and let our independent and unbiased research staff help you find the best investments. Get started today with Morningstar Premium.
And finally, Ben Johnson on the active decision-making behind index funds.
Hi, I'm Christine Benz from Morningstar.com. Even if you own an index fund or ETF, that doesn't mean that there's not some active decision-making going on behind the scenes. Joining me to discuss that topic is Ben Johnson. He's director of Morningstar's Global ETF Research. Ben, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Christine.
Ben, you wrote a recent piece about the evolution of indexes. And let's talk about that, because I think index fund investors might not appreciate that indexes didn't start out as something to invest in.
That's absolutely right. I think most investors, when they think of indexes, they think of a means of measurement, no different really than, say, the metric system. But different from the metric system, whereby once we decided a meter is a meter and a kilogram is a kilogram and will be now and forever, indexes are living, breathing organisms. They continue to grow, they continue to evolve, and over the years they've evolved in very meaningful ways. At first, they were designed to be measures, to try to give us a sense of where markets are going, where they've been. More recently, they've evolved into being targets. They're the underpinnings of investable funds, most notably with the launch of the first retail index mutual fund in the mid-1970s by Jack Bogle and Vanguard. Fast forward to today, and the latest stage of their evolution has been marked by kind of a metamorphosis into, in many cases, a form of active management. So indexes have become, in many instances, exactly what they were originally designed to measure. These newer forms of indexes fit into the bucket that we've defined as strategic beta, what others will call smart beta, or factor indexes. So indexes, I think, far from being just simple measures, have become subsequently targets and now active management in many cases.
Okay, so let's talk about how even very vanilla products actually have some active decision-making going on behind the scenes. And I think the S&P 500 is a great example of that. Let's talk about how some discretion factors into how that index gets put together.
The S&P 500 is a great example, and it's an exclusive club. And there is a small group of individuals who decide who gets into that club when individuals are kicked out of that club. So if you look at a recent example whereby PG&E has been removed from the S&P 500 index, that group of individuals that is part of a committee at S&P Dow Jones Indices decides what's the next stock that will be voted up into that exclusive
club. And how do they look at that?
And they look at a number of different criteria. Obviously, size is important. The quality of the business is important. There are certain sort of more concrete measures that they can take into account. But nonetheless, there's going to be an element of discretion that will be involved in deciding which stocks get voted up to replace those as they graduate through that family of benchmarks, as others are removed by virtue of bankruptcy or mergers and acquisitions activity, you name it. And it drives that sort of chain reaction, that event that ultimately the discretion lies with a committee, a group of individuals.
Okay, so that's discretion related to the construction of an index itself. But there is also discretion at the provider level, where the provider can choose which index a product tracks. Let's talk about that piece of it.
And that discretion, which is ultimately what most directly affects investors, it can be exercised, and it resides kind of along a continuum in terms of the level of impact. So we've seen index changes in recent years whereby some funds, notably many Vanguard funds, have gone from standard versions of their target benchmarks to more expansive at the margin versions of those same target benchmarks. So generally speaking, adding smaller and even micro cap stocks into the mix in some cases, because those funds have grown tremendously in recent years. They need a wider berth, and they can afford a wider berth because they have more money to invest in those smaller names without incurring huge amounts of costs, without sort of taking away from what their core objective is, which is to deliver high fidelity tracking of that index.
So the provider wants to track the index as closely as possible, and the way to do that is to maybe bring in some of the smaller names that heretofore had not been included.
That's right.
Okay.
To build a portfolio that represents the market in its broadest sense for investors. Now, that's one end of the spectrum, and that doesn't really ultimately move the needle a ton for the end investor. Now, at the other end of that continuum are some extreme examples, one of which being an ETF that had up until fairly recently been a Latin American real estate ETF that had a lobotomy of sorts and woke up one morning and was a marijuana ETF. So a wholesale shift in the underlying index, the underlying strategy, you name it.
And not at all what investors necessarily were bargaining for when they bought the thing in the first place.
Not at all what they signed up for in the first place. And what you see between those two extremes on the continuum are a variety of different sort of shades, a variety of different gradients, where either there are outright index changes in some cases. In other cases, there might be changes to index methodologies. And all of these are important for investors to understand to decide whether or not, in some cases, is this still what I signed up for originally? In other cases, how might this affect the risk, the return profile of the portfolio that I own?
So some due diligence on an ongoing basis for me as an investor is crucial. How do I kind of stack the deck in my favor to ensure that the discretion, to the extent that it's happening, is sort of on my side, that these decisions are being made with my best interests at heart, not necessarily with the provider's interests at heart?
I think investors can protect themselves, can sleep well at night if they invest in the most broad-based, the most well-diversified, the lowest-cost index products that are out there on the marketplace. Those are the ones, similar to the example I described, that at the margin are growing ever larger, can expand that opportunity set that they're investing in directly for investors. By virtue of doing that, because they have such large scale, are offering those portfolios at the lowest possible costs, in some cases for next to nothing.
Right.
If not, after accounting for just good portfolio management, in all intents and purposes, for nothing. Those are the ones that I think at the margin are going to continue to evolve and evolve in a way that takes into account sort of their impact on markets and evolve in a way that will be ultimately friendly to investors. Those are the ones that I think investors are best served by today and will be tomorrow and as far as we can see down the road.
Okay, Ben, always great to get your insights. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for watching. I'm Christine Benz from Morningstar.com.
That does it for this week's Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar.com. We hope you have enjoyed our program and we welcome your feedback. Please send your comments and questions to podcast@Morningstar.com. From everyone here at Morningstar, thanks for listening.
Sponsored by Oppenheimer Funds, a leader in global investing.